Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We know, weather is not the same as climate change. But when climate change shows up, it shows up as weather. And this year, we have seen a lot of that. Heat and drought and flood so damaging, so arresting that it has grabbed a lot of Americans by the collar and given us a shake. So what now? This hour On Point, climate change outlook and attitudes after the scary weather year of 2012. You can join the conversation today. Has this year shaken you up, made you wonder where we're headed, lit up our future? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. 2012, with its wild weather, saw everything from record ice melt to drought, hurricanes, wildfire, record highs just in the last few days. In December, if you were tuned in, here's a bit of what we've heard in this year.
On the 3rd of December, temperatures in the plains and Midwest are kind of unnerving, including 70 degrees in Chicago.
There are fires that burn incredibly hot, incredibly destructively, and these are fires that we have really never seen in the historical records.
All of these homes underwater. Again, we're talking about a good 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 blocks inland.
I remember the drought of 88 that was a nationwide drought. And of course, this one will now be in the memory banks as the year I should have just took a leave of absence.
The ice that for millennia nearly covered the Arctic Ocean has been melting so quickly that the polar ice cap today is the smallest it's been since satellite record keeping began more than 30 years ago.
What a year. So what are we thinking at the end nearly of 2012? With us now from New Haven, Connecticut is Anthony Leiserwitz, a big expert on public opinion on climate change, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, research scientist at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale. He's just returned from the big United Nations climate change talks going on in Doha. Tony Leiserwitz, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
And from Washington, with a deeper look at the future of climate policy, Vicky Arroyo joins us, Executive Director of the Georgetown Climate Center of Georgetown University Law Center. Vicky Arroyo, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Tony, take us right in on public attitudes, outlook, opinions at the end of this incredible year of, you name it, drought, wildfire, right on down the list. Where do Americans stand in their evolving outlook on what's going on with the global climate?
Okay, so it's been really an interesting thing to track. So we've been tracking public opinion for the past decade, and one of the things that we saw very clearly from 2007, if I can take you back just a few years, that was kind of the high water mark. I mean, that was the year that, you know, Inconvenient Truth really hit.
Al Gore's and film, yep.
That's right. And the Inconvenient Truth won an Academy Award, Al Gore, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which produces these synthesis reports for the entire scientific community. That happened in 2007, and they won a Nobel Prize. There was a lot of media coverage, a lot of attention, and that really was the high water mark. But then came 2008 and 2009 and 2010, and we saw, as did every other survey organization tracking this, a big decline in public understanding of climate change, that it's happening, that it's human-caused, as well as their levels of worry. But since it bottomed out in about 2010, it started creeping slowly back up until what we've just seen in our latest national survey conducted last September, so just a couple months ago, but pre-Sandy, I must say, we found that levels of belief have risen almost to the level that they were back in 2007. So today, about 7 out of 10 Americans, 70%, believe that climate change is happening. About 54% believe that it's primarily human-caused. And we now find that about 58% say that they're worried about it. And these are all pretty substantial increases since even last March.
Vicky Arroyo, you're there in Washington. Can you feel a change in the attitude in our, you know, National Legislative Center? Not that much gets done in Congress these days, but what about attitudes there when it comes to climate and the need to do something, do more?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think people are not just hearing the warnings of the scientists who are saying the rate of ice loss in Greenland is unprecedented. And, you know, we're very concerned about the consequences for sea level rise. But people are really starting to feel this in their bones. I mean, all the examples that you had at the top of the program, the drought that keeps going on, affecting the Mississippi River traffic, Superstorm Sandy, in people's own backyards, they're seeing changes that you know, they don't recognize from their life experience. And so it really is starting to stimulate a conversation, together with the recent election, where I think you did see candidates that care about clean energy and moving away from the fossil fuels that are causing climate change. They won in the recent election. And so I think people are hopeful that we will see some policy now move forward, either within the Obama administration, where they have the authority without Congress, or more ideally with Congress.
We're going to look at policy implications, but just the public opinion itself, the way it's swayed by what's all around us. I mean, I'm looking here, Tony, Vicky, at a new Zogby poll. Two-thirds of voters say elected officials should take steps now to reduce the impact of climate change on future generations. Just 27% say we should wait for more evidence. Strong majority say climate change is adding to the severity of recent extreme weather. 7 in 10, as you say, Tony, greatly or somewhat worried about the growing cost and risks of extreme weather disasters fueled by climate change. And it's not just ordinary folks watching the news. I mean, I think this is from you, Tony, looking at the World Bank. President, they're saying the global climate is moving outside the bounds of past experience. That seems to be what people are feeling in their bones, Tony.
That's correct. And in fact, we again see this right in our own studies as well. So even last spring, so back in March, before the record temperatures of this summer, before the wildfires of Colorado, and of course what we've seen with Hurricane Sandy and so forth, even back then, 8 out of 10 Americans said that they had personally experienced one or more extreme weather events in the previous year. Because if you remember, last year, 2011, was an all-time record-setting year of extreme weather. We had 14 individual extreme weather events that cost the nation at least $1 billion or more. So 8 out of 10 Americans said they had personally experienced that, and about a third of them said that they had been personally harmed, either their property or financially or physically.
I mean, Vicky, the interesting thing here is that we've had it drummed into us that weather is not climate. Climate is a great long arc. Weather happens day by day, even minute by minute. On the other hand, Vicky, when climate change shows up, it is going to show up massively as weather.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we used to say, as people who've worked on climate change, that you can't peg any individual weather event to climate change. But more and more, we're seeing the weight of the evidence where storms like Sandy have been fueled by a combination of factors, including warmer oceans and the atmosphere, contributing to a supercharged storm, if you will. So the intensity of the storms that we're seeing of the extreme weather is certainly exacerbated by climate change.
And the costs are being driven home as well, right into local communities. Some of the biggest ones, the biggest one in the country, New York City. Here was, this was early November, New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo talking with reporters after Hurricane Sandy, saying, look, climate change cannot be ignored.
There's a reality that has existed for a long time that we have been blind to. And that is climate change, extreme weather, call it what you will, and our vulnerability to it. It was true 10 years ago. It was true 5 years ago. It is undeniable today.
Massive costs and human dislocation on the East Coast along a very wide swath and right there in New York City. Go to the West Coast. Here's former Malibu Mayor Jefferson Wagner describing the eroding California coast and putting the blame on human-caused climate change.
These things are happening. We have to realize that they're happening. We're seeing it here. There's no denying it any longer.
Take it to the middle of the country, Colorado Springs. In June, Mayor Steve Bock telling reporters the fury and scale of the wildfires around his city were just beyond what anybody there had seen. Were unbelievable, he said.
I looked at the people from the Forest Service when we all turned around and saw that fire jump those two ridges. I saw their mouths drop, if I could say that. I think they were stunned at what they saw. I was.
Tony Elijewicz, you've followed this a lot. How does this psychology work? On the one hand, the sort of smack across the face that's been going on for a couple of years here could be, well, let's get busy, let's do something. On the other hand, you could go from, I don't believe it's happening, to it's happening and it's overwhelming and there's nothing we can do, paralysis.
Sure, but I think it's really important to recognize that there is no single response. In fact, we found in our own research that six distinct Americas within the United States that each respond quite differently to this issue. So we have one group of Americans we call the alarmed. These are people who are convinced it's happening, human caused, think it's a very serious and urgent problem. Then you have a group that we call the concerned. They think it's happening and human caused, but they think it's still relatively distant. So distant in time and next generation, or distant in space. This is about polar bears or small island countries, not the United States. Then a group we call the cautious. They're still trying to make up their mind. They're paying attention, but can't quite figure out who to believe. Then a group we call the disengaged, who have heard the term global warming but don't know anything about it. Then the doubtful, who are predisposed to think it's not happening, but if it is, it's natural, nothing we had anything to do with, nothing we can do anything about. And then last but not least, about 10% of Americans that we call the dismissive, and who are firmly convinced it's not happening, not human caused, and many think it's a hoax. Now, each of those groups responds to new information from the science community as well as these kinds of events in very different ways. So the dismissive, as an example, if you take you back to, if you remember Snowpocalypse and Snowmageddon, you know, those big snow events on the East Coast, they looked at those and said, aha, look, there's proof that global warming's not happening. By contrast, some of the alarmed looked at things like the Joplin tornadoes that happened a couple of years ago, that terrible tragedy, and said, look, there's global warming. Well, actually, there is no scientific known link between climate change and tornadoes. Lots of between climate change and, say, extreme temperatures and wildfires and other things, but not with tornadoes. So both of those two extremes are kind of predisposed to use weather to validate what they already believe.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the climate change outlook and attitudes in this country after the crazy, scary weather of 2012. Tony Leiserwitz, Anthony Leiserwitz, joins us from Yale in New Haven, Connecticut. Vicky Arroyo from the Georgetown Climate Center in Washington, D.C. This was in July, a little sound here, Tony, Vicky. In Mountain Grove, Missouri, cattle farmer Duncan Smith said that over time he's seen ups and downs in the weather, but nothing like this year.
We're going in a three-year cycle. 03 was bad. 06 was worse. 09 was suicide watch. And now we are in 2012. And I've got friends. I don't know whether to jump with them or talk them down.
Don't know whether to jump with them or talk them down in the face of all that drought. Here, Hurricane Sandy comes in and hit towns up and down the East Coast. Levee broke outside Little Ferry. Here's a resident there.
This is the scariest experience of my life. When you wake up, you call 911, you call the police, and it's busy. You have no one to go to. Water's rushing in, water's going by, and you don't know what to do.
Some skeptics turned around. Here was Lolly Hellman, after watching the film Chasing Ice about the decline of glaciers around the world, became a believer.
I watch Bill O'Reilly every day. I love Bill O'Reilly. I'm proud to be an American. But I saw this movie, Chasing Ice, today. And it hasn't just changed me about global warming. It has changed me as a person.
And you want a scientist? Here's a longtime skeptic, Professor of Physics Richard Mueller, saying he gathered his own data. And here he was this summer, Democracy Now!
I got to admit, I was shocked when I saw the results. There was short-term variability that was due to volcanoes, essentially nothing. Due to the solar variation. Theoretically, that's not too surprising, but I was surprised nonetheless. But the remaining curve, the rise in that curve, was dead on to human production of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases.
And we keep pumping them out. Tony Leiserwitz and Vicky Arroyo are with us. We're eager to hear from you. Brady in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Brady, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
What do you see?
Well, you know, I live in Iowa, and in Iowa is, of course, you know, one of those Midwestern states that where you see the full range of the seasons, and you see, you know, the clear distinction between summer, winter, spring, fall. You know, you see the seasons here, but lately I've noticed that winter doesn't get here as fast as it did. I mean, I'm only 28 years old, I realize, so I'm still a relatively young guy, but I feel like I remember seeing snow, like, you know, around the Thanksgiving time of the year, and you just don't see that here anymore. And I constantly see these Facebook updates from my friends who are, you know, they're really excited. Oh, hey, just went for a run. It's December 9th, and I have a T-shirt on. And I'm always pretty quick to you know, reply to their posts and say, look, you know, having a T-shirt on December 8th, yeah, sure, that's great if you live in, you know, in Pensacola or something like that.
right, in Florida.
In Iowa, it's supposed to be chilly here right now, you know?
Brady, I appreciate your call. I mean, it can be, it's the weird thing about it, Tony, Vicky, and thank you, Brady. It can be very pleasant to have that warm weather when you might be freezing otherwise, but in the summertime when it's drought and the crops aren't coming up, that's another thing entirely. Just sit with us and think for a minute, Tony, about what people should make of the weather events we're seeing here. Because, you know, we know that weather can come and go. For all I know, another couple of years, it'll be colder again or very rainy. So what about the influence of this on public opinion? Are we just prisoners of what we see out the window right this minute? Is it important to look at it? I mean, when it does come, that's how it will show up. Is it here?
Yeah, so here's a simple analogy that comes out of the climate science community increasingly is a nice way to think of this is like think of a baseball player who's suddenly started taking steroids. You know, this is a baseball player who prior to juicing his system was basically, you know, he could hit the ball out of the park and hit an occasional home run.
Okay.
But as he starts taking steroids, he starts hitting the ball out of the park more and more often and hitting it farther and farther. That, in essence, is what we're doing with greenhouse gases. We're juicing the world's atmospheric system and making it more likely that we get these extreme events. You know, I think that captures a really simple way of understanding that, you know, you can't say that any one of those home runs hit after the player was hit by or was yeah. started taking steroids was caused by the steroids. But when you look at the overall pattern, and that's the key word, pattern, you begin to see that things are changing. And that's the thing that we're seeing in our results as well with the American public. You know, before, if you just experienced the occasional record temperature or occasional flood, it was just one time. And there's an old saying, once is happenstance, twice is coincidence. Three times is the beginning of a pattern. And when things start happening four, five, six, seven, eight, and we see this incredibly long string of record-setting violent and extreme weather events, many people start connecting the dots and saying, whoa, what is this? Could this have something to do with climate change?
Vicky, I'm very interested in public psychology around this and the way it may or may not show up in policy. I mean, you know, how does it play out? If you've looked at this, do we go from a whole lot of people concerned about it, a whole lot of others dismissive or denying? Do we go from denial to despair and surrender, or does the new attention being paid to this and people's visceral concern about it translate into political sway and policy efforts to combat it?
Well, I'm not trained in psychology, but I do worry about that. I do worry that we go from a conversation about whether or not anything's happening to, oh my goodness, not only is it happening, but it's too late to do anything about it. And I do think that we've lost some time because since the 2007-2008 period that you started, Tony, saying that was sort of the high watermark in terms of public engagement with Inconvenient Truth coming out, mm-hmm. we saw a climate bill pass the House that year for the first time ever in 2009, but then stall in the Senate. And then since then, it's even been difficult to say the words climate change in political or policy discourse or even polite company at a dinner party. And I think it's a combination of things. One was the down economy and our leaders, not just our political leaders, but even leaders of traditional environmental groups, were told that the messaging about solving this problem should really come only in the context of creating clean energy jobs, for example, and okay. not really scaring
Make
people.
It about jobs, not about climate.
Exactly. But I think that we should really also call out the fact that there was an organized misinformation campaign by fossil fuel interest in this country to really attack not just the underlying science, but the scientists personally. Mm-hmm. And that had a chilling effect as well. And so you see people like the person who we heard a bit of a clip from earlier in your program talking about believing Bill O'Reilly usually, but now she's moving on. Well, you know, Bill O'Reilly is not a scientist. And one report of he said, she said is not the same thing as the weight of the scientific evidence, which has really been present for many, many years now. But here we are now just engaging in a national conversation, which President Obama says that he is going to himself get engaged in. And that's what we need. We really do need for him to get engaged and to really lead that conversation.
We'll see about that, what that might mean. It's really interesting where the alarm bells send us here. Let's get a call from Springfield, Illinois. Ben's calling. Hi, Ben. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Back in 2006, I was in a position to build a home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking at the global climate change problem at that time, I decided to do it in a sustainable manner and build out a reclaimed materials and tear down barns. And I did all of that as what I thought was my responsibility, you know, to help stem the tide or prevent this from happening. And
respect.
Now, through the course of doing that, though, my attitude has changed in as the data comes in that really it's more about survival in a new ecosystem practically that, you know, we should still continue to do the green thing, but now it's not about prevention, it's about survival, because I think that the mechanisms of change are too far progressed. And but it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, but, you know, we if it's for different reasons.
And Ben, are you saying that because you believe, holy smokes, we're so far gone, we can't stop it, so all you can do is hunker down and deal?
Yeah, and the same methods that were valid for prevention are as valid for survival. Like when, you know, you're thinking about finite resources and food sources and water and fuel sources, if you live in an efficient manner, your chances of thriving or surviving in that those new conditions are better.
Well, that is a very interesting kind of hybrid view there. Ben, I appreciate your call. Tony Lazarowicz, there it is. I mean, you know, whoops. You know, our chance at a great green future slipped right by, and it's already survivalist time in a new ecosystem, Ben says. What do you say to that attitude, Tony?
Well, so Ben's perspective is, I mean, it's still relatively small in terms of the number of people that we see saying that. But on the other hand, it is growing because people have felt like there isn't getting, we're not seeing progress. So it's a very real concern. I mean, here's what I would say is that, look, it's like we're in a car and we're heading towards, you know, driving through the mist and we're driving towards a brick wall that's somewhere out in front of us. And, you know, we're driving at about 80 miles an hour. We're distracted, fiddling with the radio, you know, probably eating a hamburger in our hand. You know, there's kids screaming in the back who aren't buckled, by the way. And, you know, we have a choice at this point. We are going to hit some sort of a climate wall. That is now indisputable. And we're already beginning to see the impacts, and we have, you know, we're going to see more.
But what does that mean, hit a climate wall? I mean, people may say, well, I don't know. We'll have to move back a mile from the seashore. We'll have to, you know, I don't know, live underground. I don't know what it will be, but humans survive. You listen to Ben. He's ready to survive.
Well, the point is how fast do we hit that wall? And that's really my key point here. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between hitting a wall at about 10 miles an hour, in which case you end up with some bumps and bruises and maybe a mild case of whiplash, versus hitting the wall at 70 or 80 miles an hour. And that's really the choice that we have before us. We need to put on the brakes, absolutely, because it will make a huge difference. But at the same time, we need to be essentially buckling ourselves in and getting ready and building more resiliency in our communities, because many of them were built with the assumption that the climate would be the way it was in the past. And as we're seeing, as things change, these structures, our homes, our roads, our bridges, our hospitals, and so on, have been built in a world that really isn't going to exist in the future, and we need to take action now to protect them.
But the question there is, Vicky, for individuals, you know, are you buying solar panels or are you buying a diesel generator so that when the power grid goes out, you've got yours?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. And my family lost their homes in Katrina, so I've seen the personal toll that storms take on people. And I do think that we all need to look at our communities and our own lives and our own investments and say, what is in store? And if you live along the coast, it makes sense to perhaps consider retreating over time or rebuilding or building differently, certainly after a storm or a flood event, looking at how we can minimize urban heat island impacts of climate change by painting our roofs white to be more reflective. And that saves energy, and it also helps to cool the building. Or planting gardens on roofs. You have a green roof, then it actually cools the whole neighborhood as well as your own individual home. So some of the policies that you would put in place to adapt to climate change also have a mitigation benefit.
Where are we in the arc of, if we're on this arc of climate change, where are we in it? I mean, how much increase is already baked into the future and how much can be forestalled or put off? The goal was to keep it under a 2 degrees Celsius change. Now I'm seeing people talk about, you know, flying right past that. Is that already, and that could be catastrophic in many areas. Where are we on that arc, Vicky? How much climate change can be put off at this point, and how much is just baked in the cake already?
Well, I mean, I think the recent World Bank report that you alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. and IEA, the International Energy Administration, our agency, says that the world is heading to more like a 4 or 6 degree Celsius rise if we stay on our current trajectory, as opposed to stopping at 2 degrees, which is what the world was trying to work together collectively.
And what does that difference mean?
Well, I mean, it means that we really are likely to see very significant rises in sea level rise, maybe not in a very, very long period of time, but even over the next century. And I think it does make it difficult for those who are trying to advise people about how to plan accordingly. You know, the truth is that we really are dealing outside of the bounds of human experience here. We can look back in, you know, the millions and millions of year record and see that there have been very dramatic changes. We were not around to experience them, but now we might very well be. And so we really do have to look hard at what we can do to cope in a relatively short amount of time with dramatic change. And when you consider all the people who live around the world, not just in our country, in large urban areas around the coast, that's pretty significant expense to try to figure out what to do with all these people who are going to be vulnerable. You can't just put up seawalls to solve this problem.
The World Bank chief outlining implications of a 4 degree centigrade increase in temps, looking at, you know, sort of ticking them off: inundation of coastal cities, increasing risks for food production, unprecedented heat waves, substantially exacerbated water scarcity, more frequent high intensity tropical cyclones, hurricanes, irreversible loss of biodiversity. But, Tony, that's if, as Vicky says, we say in a kind of a straight line increase or the path we're on now. What's doable? You're just back from Doha, the big UN conference there. I don't know how hopeful that is, but how much of that arc could we pull back from and still avoid?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that when you look at, for instance, the climate projections of will we end up at a 2 degree, 4 degree, 6 degree world. And by the way, if we hit 4 degrees, that is definitely a world that none of us wants to live in or have our children live in. And thinking of 6 degrees it's actually unthinkable.
Paint the world. What's it look like? The 4 degree,
oh,
five, six.
I mean, you're talking about massive disruption in natural ecosystems, massive disruption in our food supply, in the water supply. The middle part of the world will become much drier. We probably have well past loss of the Amazon rainforest. We may see major shifts in things like the monsoon system that is the primary source of water for the entire Indian and Southeast Asian subcontinent.
So you're talking masses of people on the move, desperate, everything that comes with that.
It's not a place you want to live.
And we're on that path? Is that what I heard Vicky say?
We are currently on that path. But the biggest source of uncertainty in these climate projections, and I cannot say this strongly enough, is that we don't know yet how human beings are going to act. It is totally within our control to choose what kind of future we want. So that's really the challenge for human beings, is what do we want out of that future? And what choices are we willing to make now to get this future that we would prefer?
Can we still stay in that 2% hike range if we do what it takes?
Yeah, I mean, certainly all the experts that study this say that many of the technologies that we need to actually stay right at about 2 degrees are already in hand. Now, the longer we wait, the bigger and harder it gets, because there are lag times into this system. It's not like simply, you know, shutting off a coal-fired power plant and suddenly the air gets cleaner in that city. CO2 goes up in the atmosphere and it stays up there for at least 100 years. And so, you know, the climate we're experiencing right now is in essence the CO2 and other greenhouse gases that were emitted, you know, several generations ago. Meanwhile, the CO2 we're putting in the air now is going to have a lasting impact in future years. So that's why it's so imperative that we begin taking action immediately to forestall the damage that's going to be done later down the road.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the climate change outlook and attitudes in this country and around the world after the crazy, scary weather of 2012. Anthony Leiserwitz is with us from Yale University, New Haven, Connecticut. Vicky Arroyo from the Georgetown Climate Center in Washington, D.C. Want to look at paths ahead, but a couple callers here. Zenon's calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Zenon, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I think what bothers me about this conversation is that we are missing an essential demographic. I keep hearing you talk about those who don't believe in global warming and people who believe in it and are panicked. But we're missing a huge demographic, which is people who accept that global warming is happening and welcome it with open arms.
I like the fact that
the temperatures are rising. I like the fact that the Arctic shipping lanes are opening. This is going to lead to more commerce, to lower prices. Sure, the coasts might be adversely affected, but that means inland areas are going to see their property values go up. That means inhospitable areas are going to become hospitable.
So embrace the change, you say, Zine. Embrace the change. Roll with it. Is that it?
Absolutely. Change is the human nature and capitalism is of such a nature that we adapt to change. If the Connecticut's become the Carolinas, fantastic. If we have more drought, then perhaps we start exploiting the natural resources in the Great Lakes.
Zina, let us pick it up. Let me pick it up right there, Tony Lazarowitz. Hey, this rocks. Let's roll with it. What do you say, Tony?
Oh, my. Well, first of all, I would say that contrary to his claim, we see that's actually a very small minority opinion in this country. It's certainly less than 10%, and I would say it's probably more around 1% or 2%. Nonetheless, I think we have to admit and be clear that there are always going to be some pluses and, in this case, however, many minuses. But there will be a few pluses. As things get warmer, you're going to pay less probably for winter energy bills because you won't have to heat your house as much. Yes, the Arctic will open to shipping lanes. On the other hand, that's exposing one of the world's most vulnerable ecosystems to large-scale commercial traffic. It's opening up huge reservoirs of additional fossil fuel and carbon burning as companies start trying to drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean, not just in the rest of offshore of the United States. And what that really ignores is the fact that all of our systems are built for the current climate system. They're not built for the system that's coming. And that we are all embedded in these globally now interlinked systems of food and water and health and security systems that are completely dependent on the system as it exists today, the climate system that exists today. To suddenly shift and wrench the world into a different kind of food production system, that's just not going to happen. If we lose the breadbasket of the United States, as an example, you can't just go farm in Alaska. There is no topsoil in Alaska, and it doesn't change the way that the sun's light hits the Earth. It comes at an extreme angle in the North Pole. So even though that's by temperature a place where you could grow food, you literally can't grow food there.
But you can hear the adaptive human psychology looking for ways to say, let's go with this, Tony.
Well, to one extent, we're going to have no choice. We are going to have to adapt, and we will. I don't think that's a major question. The question, though, is to what are we going to adapt? Are we going to adapt to something that is a moderate change, like 2 degrees, which, by the way, even 2 degrees is still going to be difficult to adapt to?
Yep.
Or are we going to try to adapt to some really extreme changes like 3, 4, 5, or 6 degrees?
I'll bring it to you, Vicky. Let's get a call here from Mandeville, Louisiana. Maurice is calling. Hi, Maurice. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Awesome. I've been a fan and a listener for a long time.
Great.
This just seemed like the issue to call in on.
Great.
Mandeville is about 30 minutes from New Orleans. So clearly, we've seen tons of weather. Good, bad, and the ugly over the years. And I don't think the argument is so much whether or not the climate is changing. We've had barometers and thermometers for, hundreds of years now.
Yeah.
The thing is perspective. My belief is that it's a selfish human instinct to think that that we have the potential to do all of this on our own, to do all the damage that we're doing, when, frankly, 15 minutes of volcanic activity puts out more greenhouse gases than all of human civilization can do in a year. It's not that we're not contributing, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't work toward a much greener future.
Yeah,
I think it's really just selfish of us to think that it's all our fault.
Or kind of egotistical, kind of human centric to think that we're doing it all. What about the scientists who say we are, Maurice? You write them off?
Well, it's not. The thing is, they can't go back hundreds of years and check out what's supposed to happen. They can only see the results. And so, I mean, we're pointing fingers at cars and cows and all that. And I understand that those are definitely contributing matters. But like I said, you know, you get a volcanic eruption and it totally changes the balance.
So you look at the change and you want to feel some humility. But then there is that scientific consensus that it's happening, and we're at the heart of it. Vicky, what do you say to Maurice, who just can't believe that we little humans are really the rudder, you know, that's turning this ship?
Well, I mean, I can understand that instinct, but the truth is that there is a scientific fact base here. And in fact, the scientists can look at proxies like ice cores and tree rings and see what has happened over generations and how greenhouse gas emissions from other causes over millennia have driven the climate system. And we're the ones who are now, you know, digging the fossil fuels out of the ground and putting it up in the air. And so the rate of change is as disturbing as anything else. And, you know, so to the previous caller's point about being able to adapt, I mean, all of this isn't going to go smoothly, as we've seen with some of these storms. And there's a tremendous amount of human suffering. There's also natural systems to worry about and animal life and ocean acidification that comes from putting CO2 in the atmosphere and having it fall into the oceans and turn into carbonic acid and affect the lives of shellfish and things like that. So, you know, we really can't be sanguine about this. And just on the particular point about volcanic activity, the truth is that on balance, volcanic activity actually has a cooling effect. In fact, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, I'm a board member who oversees that organization through UCAR, their parent corporation, actually had been asked during the Bush years to do some scenarios about simulating volcanic eruptions by adding particulate matter to the atmosphere because it actually temporarily cools the planet. So it's just not true that greenhouse gases are not driving this warming and that those greenhouse gases aren't primarily coming from human activity, mainly fossil fuel burning, but also, importantly, other greenhouse gas contributions that even have higher global warming potential, like refrigerants or methane. And these are things that we can actually curb in the short run. And, you know, in talking about solutions, I think those are some of the things that we should look towards.
I want to look at those. I mean, myself, I kind of like the natural world. I'm pretty fiercely fond of it. And I don't know how much I want to just see you blown away. Rebecca, Franklin, Tennessee. Rebecca, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm well. What do you think? What are you thinking as you listen to all this, Rebecca?
Well, you know, I do believe that global warming is happening. I do believe that humans have had a great effect on it. But as an individual who wants to make a difference, it's incredibly overwhelming to try to figure out where you begin as an individual, what changes you need to make in your daily life. And then on the flip side of that is that, you know, I guess some of those, the options are rather expensive if there are certain things in your life that you purchase that you make that you need to change. And then are they convenient? You know, and I think that's another aspect of it is kind of the selfishness. Well, how much is it going to change, you know, my efforts in my day-to-day to be more mindful?
You know, I think a lot of people have exactly that in mind, Rebecca. We'll go right to that if you'll permit me. Let me get one more call, and we'll go to it. Let me hold that, Rebecca. One more. Matt in Lexington, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that one of the problems that we have is the scale of the change that your experts and many believe is necessary for us to avoid the worst consequences of global warming is just so difficult to get people to change their behavior when that behavior may conflict with underlying value systems, you know, whether they are economic or spiritual or whatnot. That I think, you know, one thing that gets left out of the conversation is tying in how the behavioral changes affect the values that we hold, you know, in terms of freedom and being able to get in your car and drive off wherever you want to. Those things need to get examined when we're talking about the science, too.
Let me take that perspective and Rebecca's to the challenge here. Vicky, I mean, there's the question, you know, are we up to this behaviorally? As a species. I mean, Rebecca asks about it in individual lives. What about cost and convenience? Matt's looking at the scale of it, and it can look overwhelming. Are we up to this? And describe for us, you know, what would it take? What's it going to take to begin to put the brakes on this more effectively, Vicky, policy-wise?
Well, so it can look daunting, but government plays a role, right? And if you look at the fuel economy standards that we put in place under the first Obama term, the automobile efficiency standards, they're going to be able to save people money at the pump. At the same time, we're reducing dramatically not only our dependence on foreign oil, but the greenhouse gases that we're pumping into the atmosphere. And so building on what he did his first term on transportation, we can move over and look at what EPA can now do using existing authority without Congress.
But everybody says that's great, but that wasn't nearly enough. There's going to have to be a lot more. Like what? How soon? What?
Well, power plants. I mean, so power plants are responsible for roughly 40% of our emissions. We can curb the emissions from power plants. We haven't had standards in the past. EPA proposed standards for new sources of CO2 from power plants.
Curb them by shutting them down? But how?
So their standards for new sources that they proposed basically require emissions at the level of a clean natural gas facility. Okay. So for coal plants, they either phase out if they're too inefficient, or they capture the CO2 and sequester it in the ground. That's, you know, a technology option.
Yep. Carbon
so
capture.
there are technologies, as Tony said, there are technologies that are available.
Take us on. So there's mileage, there's power plants. What else is it going to take? Matt is imagining, you know, challenges to our everyday ways of living that people may find unacceptable or difficult.
But what's interesting, if you look, we at the Georgetown Climate Center, we work a lot with states, and governors have articulated why to do this, not just because they're on the front lines and they're seeing the consequences of not acting on climate change, but they're seeing opportunities for things like renewable energy and efficiency to plow money back into their economies and to create new jobs.
So you're talking alternative energy sources. What about in our daily lives? If we are going to get on top of this, are we going to live different lives than we live now? Are they going to be in some fundamental ways? What?
Well, I mean, technology is part of it. And so the car that you drive might be different from the car that you otherwise would drive.
Yeah.
But you know, if we change where the power comes from, do you know where the electrons in your own home come from? I don't think necessarily. And I think a lot of people
prefer
to come from.
Okay, there's two. We got that. There's your power plants. Take us on.
Right. So, I mean, some of it might come in the form of driving less. And the way that you can try to achieve that is to price carbon. That's something that people have been talking about for a long time.
A carbon
tax.
They
need to have some kind of carbon tax. And given the fiscal cliff discussions, given the deficit discussions, you know, maybe we could talk about also relieving, you know, other tax burdens. But tax a bad instead of a good. Tax what we burn as opposed to what we earn, as I think Al Gore is saying right
now. What about the cost of all this? Is it going to further bring down our standard of living to pay for these changes?
Well, so some of the states that actually have these policies in place, like the New England and Mid-Atlantic states that have a cap-and-trade program in place, have done a study that actually shows that the fact that they've taken money from a cap-and-trade program and reinvested it in their economy has actually created jobs and benefited their GDP in that region.
So it can work that way. Tony, what do you say about human adaptability here? Is this beyond us?
Oh, I don't think it's beyond us. It is a question mostly of politics. But I'd like to come back to Rebecca's point of, you know, it's easy to get overwhelmed by the size and scale of this, because it is. It's the kind of a problem that we've rarely faced before as a species. But first, we have to recognize that there is no silver bullet. It's going to take silver buckshot, or if I can use a different metaphor, it's an all hands on deck kind of moment. It's akin to the kind of effort that the United States put forward when it came to winning World War II. You know, there are times in human history when we are willing to band together because we all see we have a common threat. And in this case, we also have a common opportunity. This is our chance to define and to build the sustainable world that we want to live in. That'll actually not just be the status quo world that we live in now, but actually a better world, a cleaner world, a healthier world.
Yeah, that's hallelujah. But there's politics, as you say, right in the middle of it. Fossil fuels have been pretty effective in muddying the waters around this issue. Where do you see that going? I mean, every time I turn on the TV, I see these big ads for, you know, this great oil future or carbon future that's coming.
Right. But that's what's actually really interesting, is that despite all the millions of dollars that the fossil fuel industry has spent to try to promote their brand, so to speak, it hasn't really taken hold. The vast majority of Americans still see fossil fuels, especially coal and oil, as very dirty and polluting, whereas they have just the opposite view of the alternatives, like solar and wind. And in fact, when we ask Americans, should the U.S. be using more renewables or more fossil fuels, they overwhelmingly, and this is a cross-partisan line, say that we should be using more renewable energy. And in fact, they want that renewable energy now. I think people are actually, there's far more consensus in the United States than most of us recognize around the goal of this clean and healthier energy future. Because remember, it's not just about climate change. Mm. Those coal-fired power plants put out lots of other particulates that cause asthma, that cause respiratory disease, have all kinds of negative health impacts on their local communities.
Vicky, China, India, all the rest, I mean, even if the U.S. does it, what about that side of the ledger? It's huge and it's all the same global pot.
No, that's true. And China is actually taking action. They have had aggressive car standards in place even before we were able to deal with ours. They are experimenting with cap and trade at the regional level within China. But no doubt that we have to engage China in bilateral agreements to reduce our emissions collectively and other major emitters like India. But, you know, the U.S. is obviously a global leader as well. We contributed to more of the emissions that have caused the warming historically up until this point. And, you know, we want to be a leader. We need to be a leader. And there are some advantages to leading because you can develop the technologies that can then be exported to the rest of the world.
So watch Doha for some of that and all the conversations coming up in the years ahead. Maybe developed countries cut back sooner. Developing, they're saying maybe cut back a little later. But on balance, maybe we can hit that mark. Is there a point of no return here, or is it always a moving target, Vicky?
Well, you know, we're learning more all the time, and having worked on this issue for some time, I have to say the surprises are mostly cutting in the direction of, you know, making us more alarmed, frankly.
The ice melting faster, the temperatures going up, the seas rising. Got our attention this year. We're paying attention. Maybe there's a big shift underway. We will see. Vicky Arroyo at the Georgetown Climate Center in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for joining us, Vicky.
Thanks, Tom.
And Tony Leiserwitz in New Haven, Connecticut. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Tomorrow on this hour, big week in the news. Join us for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.